Okay, we're now going to do lesson three. What? Yeah. We're now going to do lesson three of the Kabbalah of You. We want to welcome back our long-term student, Joyce Gorman, who took a slow boat to China. I said to Australia. So now she's finally back. Becky, you have a book? So we're going to dealing to not today. The subject of today's class is something that self-help is doing all a lot about, is about happiness, exploring the pursuit of happiness. Many of you may know that Dennis Prager wrote a book on happiness. When did he write the book? After he was a Chabad rabbi in Los Angeles that impressed him very much, so he decided to write a book on happiness because of that rabbi that he knew. So we're going to talk about happiness today. That started a few minutes late, and we're going to explain how do we attain happiness, which is not the easiest thing to do. It's not the easiest thing to do, but we're going to do our best. So let's start over here. We're going to read the first reading. Shh, could you close the kitchen door, please? Okay, we're going to read the first reading. And how the founding fathers put it, so to speak. They said we have certain inalienable rights. You want to read reading number one?
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
So here we see in the foundational statement of the United States of America this idea that we have a right to happiness.
No.
What?
We don't have a right to happiness. We have a right to pursuit of happiness.
Pursuit of happiness, okay.
A huge difference.
And now, what was the difference? Before, you had totalitarian regimes like Hamas in Gaza, which still sadly exist still today. Monarchs, dictators, etc., etc. And they blocked people from doing as they wished, and they understandably, they didn't give them the right to pursue happiness. Now, with the United States came the idea that the powers come from the consent of the government, and they should have that right to look for happiness. So, but still, we have a bigger question, which is, does Judaism agree with this idea that we have a right to the pursuit of happiness? How does Judaism look at the concept of happiness? Do you think Judaism agrees or doesn't agree? You don't think so? Joyce doesn't think so. Well, you think it does?
Absolutely.
Well, we have a right to, okay. What?
For
only one, why? Because you're taking out the guard? What? Jewish women are pursuing happiness, oppressing Jewish men, right? What? One person's opinion. Okay, good. When I get home, I'm going to tell my wife what you said. You know what I mean? Okay. You're lucky your wife is out of the room for the moment. You know what I mean?
That's why you're so...
that's his name. So we can... But also... some people have opined that this idea of happiness is more than a right, it's like an obligation. And we know in general there's a difference in Judaism and the conversation in modern Western culture. In Judaism we have responsibilities. In modern Western culture we have rights. It's a fundamental different kind of conversation. And whenever you talk to an American, you are infringing on my rights. But Judaism, we're talking about what is your responsibilities. So let's over here see what Dennis Prager has. Do you want to read to us what Dennis Prager has to say in text number 2 about this idea of what is the idea of pursuit of happiness?
We tend to think that we owe it to ourselves to be as happy as we can be. And this is true. But happiness is far more than a personal concern. It is a moral obligation.
In other words, what does Dennis say? And again, where did he start his conversation? Because he met one of the Chabad rabbis in L.A., Rabbi Schwartz. He was so touched by his sense of happiness, he decided to get involved in the issue of happiness. And he says it's a moral obligation. So continue on.
Upon a moment's reflection, this becomes obvious. We owe it to our husband or wife, our fellow workers, our children, our friends, indeed to everyone who comes into our lives to be as happy as we can be. This does not mean acting unreal, and it certainly does not mean refraining from abuse. Expressions of our feelings that are to those closest to us. But it does mean that we owe it to others to work on our own happiness. We do not enjoy being around others who are usually unhappy. Those who enter our lives feel the same way. Ask a child what it was like to grow up with an unhappy parent, or ask parents what pain they suffer if they have an unhappy child or an unhappy.
Dennis likes to compare this moral obligation of looking for happiness to the moral obligation to use mouthwash, or to take a shower. Not so much for your own sake, but for everybody around you. You know what I mean? Oh, I haven't taken a shower in 6 weeks, and you smell like a disaster zone. But we have a moral obligation. But let's take a look at what it says in Pirkei Avot, the ethics of our fathers. It's Shammai says that you have to greet every person with a glowing and positive countenance. How you interact with another person is crucial. There's a story I talk about the great rabbinical scholar of Yaakov Kamenetsky. He was a famous Rosh Yeshiva. He was a dean of one of the great rabbinical seminaries in New York. And he would take a walk every day in Muncie, and there would be a nun who was walking at the same time. And he always would greet her in a nice way. Now, the world of the nunnery and the world of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky were about as far as from east to west. But nevertheless, he felt an obligation to greet each person with a glowing and positive countenance. When you walk into a room and you're nice to somebody, the whole thing becomes better. When you see somebody and say, "Oh, what a pleasure to see you," you uplift them right with that very simple act. And what does Rabbi Ishmael say also? That we should greet every person with joy. In other words, we have a moral obligation to uplift other people. We have an obligation not just to be happy ourselves, but to bring a sense of happiness to other people. And first thing, it can be just in a simple way. You walk into the work in the morning, they look at you, it's Monday, it's like that Monday morning blues, you know what I'm talking about? There's TGIF and there's, oh, you gefalt, it's Monday. So there's a restaurant called TGIF, and there's no restaurant that says, oh, you gefalt, it's Monday. Anyway, what? Oy vey, oy vey, it's Monday. That would be really a great restaurant. No, oy vey, it's Monday. Anyway, but the fact is, when you greet another person, what's called in Hebrew, b'seir apanim yafas, in an upbeat kind of positive kind of way, and you say something nice to them, and you say, oh, it's so nice to see you today, you change the whole dynamic at this point. Because why? Because this idea of happiness is a moral obligation that you have. But the question is, there's something that goes even further. Because Judaism say it's not just an moral obligation to be happy to other people. That your wife and your children and even your mother-in-law, by the way, you can be happy with your mother-in-law also. You have an obligation to treat them nice. Read to us the next line in page 3a. It's an obligation, it's happiness is an obligation toward God. So read number 3a.
Serve God with
This is what it says in Psalms, in the Tehillim, the Psalms of King David. We should serve God with joy and come before Him with joyful songs. In other words, we have to, when we serve God, it has to be an activity. Now continue reading what Maimonides said. Now, interesting, this piece of Maimonides is not from a book, The Guide to the Perplexed. This is from the code of Jewish law. This is legal stuff. This is written in the code of Jewish law. So let's read what Maimonides writes in the code of Jewish law.
It's greatly important to be happy in the performance of a mitzvah and to take joy in the love one has for God who instructed us to observe them. One who desists from rejoicing is worthy of retribution, as it's stated Deuteronomy 28:47, that the reason for various divine punishments is because you did not serve your God with happiness and a glad.
Now what happens? What do most people think about serving God? They think about coming to Shul Yom Kippur, which means, again, I really don't understand it. I say this so many times. It costs money and there's no lunch. If I was going to go to Shul one day a year, I'd go to Purim. It's cheaper and you can get drunk. I mean, come on, let's get real. They serve a big meal, they sing and they dance, there's music, there's a little bit of good scotch. I'd rather go Yippurim to celebrate than getting Yom Kippur and feeling guilty. So one thinks that religion is really about being austere and about being religious, but no, in particular the Hasidic movement took this idea of Ividus Hashem B'Simcha, of serving God with joy, to be a very central aspect. We have to be celebratory. We have to realize that Maimonides is telling us here in the code of Jewish law that when a Jew goes to do a mitzvah, you have to do it with a sense of, it's a joyful thing to do. Oh, I have to do that. Oh yeah, I got to do that. There has to be a sense of joy in what the person is doing. So the question we have to ask ourselves, number one, is happiness and religion incompatible? Because again, a lot of people think religion is about don't do this and don't do that. And oy vey, if you go to get a cheeseburger, which I really don't know what it would taste like because I had never had one, even though I once went to this kosher restaurant in LA and I ordered a Philadelphia steak and I didn't know they put this non-dairy cheese on top of the cheese. It was terrible. Anyway, I didn't think I'm missing anything. Then there was the Kentucky Fried Chicken, used to be open in Jerusalem. So I felt once in my life I'm going to Kentucky Fried Chicken. I realized I wasn't missing that much either. You know what I mean? But nevertheless, our happiness and religion incompatible. And the truth is that religion can bring out that inner sense of spiritual joy. But we have to ask a bigger question. Why is it important to serve God with joy? What is so important about this? Why do we... And joy is an important thing. Imagine going to your teenager, and we all had this issue, and we say to them, listen, please clean up the kitchen, or please mow the lawn. Now, how much are going to go and say, oh, I'm so happy to mow the lawn because I want to do this for my parents. What? They're going to...
Not going to happen.
You know what I mean? Or when your wife tells you, no, Jack, take out the garbage. Oh, my wife wants me to clean up the house. I'm so happy. I'm serving her. It's going to be with you. But if you have joy in what you do, if you do something because you want to bring joy to somebody else, then you're going to do it one way. But if you do it something else, if the child doesn't want to make the parent happy, he'll do it. But, you know, till he'll get out and go and do it, oy vey. So we have to understand that the same thing applies to serving God. Number one, when we do a mitzvah with joy, we do it better. If you say, I have to do this mitzvah, and you wake up in the morning, oh, it's Shabbos, I got to make a meal tonight, I don't want to do it, I don't want to, it's Sukkos, I have to eat the Sukkah. I'd rather sit on my couch, it's very comfortable. It's Hanukkah, oh, I got to pull out the menorah, I'm going to put the oil with the wicks, it's going to make the table dirty, I got to worry about this and worry. If you always look, but if you say, oh, it's Sukkos, I can go outside, I can sit in my Sukkah, I can see my friends, I can say L'chaim, I can celebrate, you have a positive attitude. It's Yom Kippur. I love to fast for 25 hours and listen to the rabbi speak for 24 of those 25. You know what I mean? I love that experience. That's how it goes. It's a marathon, though. So that I love that experience. I love nothing more than that. So when you do a mitzvah with joy, we do it better. Also, we do something different. When you do a mitzvah, we have to realize it's not just something which is impacted here in the physical world. In fact, how do we help people in Israel today? Other than giving a few rubles or dollars or being politically supported, we do a mitzvah. If we put on tefillin in honor of them, we are told it has a cosmic effect on the whole destiny of the Jewish people. If we do a mitzvah in their honor and the soldiers of Israel who are standing valiantly to defend the country, it has a cosmic effect. When we do it with a sense of joy, we realize that this mitzvah is not just the act itself, but it has an impact b'kol ha'olam kulay throughout the spiritual worlds. And finally, we do something else. We show that the value of the relationship between us and God. Because when we do a mitzvah with joy, we're saying, you know what? This is an important relationship. Just like when you do something for your loved one, your brother, your sister, your wife, your grandmother, whatever it may be, and you do it with a sense of joy when you clean out that garage after 27 years of accumulating stuff, but you did it because your wife wants it done, you want to make her happy. Why it took you 27 years is a different issue. But nevertheless, you're doing it with joy. And when you serve God with joy, you're showing God that you're serving Him with joy. So serving God with joy is a very, very important thing. And we see from this that Judaism views as happiness is an obligation toward God also. Not just an obligation toward man. It's a radical idea. Ibdu es Hashem b'simcha, serve God with joy. You know, so you think when you see these pictures of these dour-looking rabbis, you know, with a Jew has to be b'simcha, has to be happy. Could you, lady, could you close the door there, please? A Jew has to be happy. Close the door because you're talking. If the Jew has to be happy.
The wall keys are?
What?
The wall keys.
What?
The keys for the wall.
I don't know which.
Move the walls over there.
It's somewhere in the classroom, as far as I know. Or look in the office. So a Jew has to be besimcha, has to be with joy. So we have this obligation to do this, to serve God with a sense of happiness also. However, it ain't so easy. Because if you remember in the earlier classes we talked about that we are struggling every single day between our two levels of consciousness. As we discussed, Jews are very schizophrenic. There is the godly soul that motivates you. These human beings are very schizophrenic. The godly soul which motivates you to do good stuff, and the animalistic soul which motivates you to do selfish stuff. So therefore, we're in a constant battle so to speak, in a wrestling ring, in a spiritual battle. One is telling us to do serve God with joy, and the other one is telling us, you know what? Don't be so happy, don't be joyful, don't celebrate the mitzvah, don't celebrate the Judaism. And there's one problem, there's no ceasefire, there's no armistice. The battle goes on forever, every single day. Bruce, you want to read to us reading number 4?
The internal or spiritual battle waged against one's negative impulses is similar to physical wrestling match. If two individuals are wrestling, each striving to fail the other, and one is lazy and lethargic, he will fall and be easy defeated, even if he is stronger than his opponent. The same applies regarding the conquest of the mind's impulses. It is impossible to defeat them from the state of laziness and heaviness, which stems from dejection, but only from the state of enthusiasm that stems from happiness and a heart that is free from any trace of worry and sadness.
Now, let me ask you a question. If you're working on a diet, you want to lose a few pounds, and you're in a happy mood, are you going to go take that quart of ice cream and eat it at 2 o'clock in the morning? What?
Yes.
Carol will. But Carol's the thinnest person in the whole room, so she never ate a quart of ice cream. Or she ate it. What?
Yes, I have.
You're still the thinnest person in the whole room, Carol. Okay? So, nevertheless, what are you going to do? It's not usually going to be joyous when you break down. You're going to get depressed and upset about something, and you're going to indulge yourself, you know? As Jackie Mason says, a Jew needs a cheese Danish. And when you're going to be, what's his naming? And when are you going to feel that? When you feel a little bit dejected. Usually when you're enthusiastic, excited about life, and you're trying to do things in a positive kind of way, you're not going to capitulate to these kinds of negative reactions. When you get depressed, or you allow yourself to get depressed, or you begin to think of the world, you get a little bit down, that's when you're going to go. But there's a bigger question we have to ask ourselves. Does success lead to happiness? In other words, you think to yourself, you know what? If I just get that raise, I'm going to be a happy person. Or maybe if I hit the sales target, I'm going to be a happy person. Or if I lose 5 more pounds, which would be a good idea, I'm going to be a happy person. Or is it really the other way around? That happiness leads to success. In other words, people who are happy, the teachings of the Torah teach us that when a person is happy, you bring success. Not when the success doesn't come because of the happiness. When a person is upbeat and he's infectious and he feels good about himself and he goes out there and he tries to do the good thing and he feels happy about life, then he's going to find success. A guy comes into the office in the morning, oy vey, I don't feel like doing this, I don't feel like doing it. He's going to be successful? No way. And guess what? Psychologists are beginning to find out what the teachings of the Torah is already. Farshid, you want to read to us number 5?
Sure. If you observe the people around you, you'll find most individuals follow a formula that has been subtly or not so subtly taught to them by their schools, their company, their parents, or society. That is, if you work hard, you will become successful. And once you become successful...
How many people have heard this line, if you work hard, you will become successful?
And once you become successful, then you'll be happy. This pattern of belief explains that most often motivates us in life. We think, if I just get that raise or hit that next sales target, I'll be happy. If I can just get that next good grade, I'll be happy. If I lose that 5 pounds, I'll be happy, and so on. Success first, happiness second. More than a decade of groundbreaking research in the fields of positive psychology and neuroscience has proven in no uncertain terms that the relationship between success and happiness is the other way around. Thanks to this cutting-edge science, we now know that happiness is the precursor to success, not merely the result, and that happiness and optimism actually fuel performance and achievement, giving us the competitive edge that I call the happiness advantage. For example, doctors put in a positive mood before making a diagnosis show almost 3 times more intelligence and creativity than doctors in a neutral state. And they make accurate diagnosis 19% faster.
So if you go to the doctor, make sure he's in a good mood. If he had a fight with his wife, oy vey, what's going to happen to you?
Optimistic salespeople outsell their pessimistic counterparts by 56%. Students primed to feel happy before taking math achievement tests far outperform their neutral peers. It turns out that our brains are literally hardwired to perform at their best, not when they are negative or even neutral, but when they are positive.
So let me ask you, when was a time in your life that your optimism broke down the greatest barriers? Seriously. When did you feel that sense, you know? What?
Children that were.
When the optimism broke down, didn't let you fall into that ultimately some good was going to come.
That it did come finally.
What?
That it did result in optimism.
Yeah, when did optimism help you out? Yes?
The fact that you live when you have a bad accident.
Okay.
When I proposed to my wife.
When you proposed to your wife. Good. So you were optimistic she would say yes.
Yes.
It must have been a big diamond that you gave her at that point. 72 carats, you know what I mean? She said she was optimistic. That's why he had so many carats. So it's also, when you have a sense of optimism, even if you have a moment of defeat, and there's some other reason that you, and you don't, you look a little deeper for some other reason why something happened, you're going to overcome the biggest problems. On the flip side, Rab Aaron of Kalin, the great Hasidic master, says that technically being despondent is not a sin, yet it can lead to spiritual depths unparalleled by the worst of sins. This is what the great Rab Aaron of Kalin says. When you begin to look negative on everything, when everything becomes, they say in Yiddish, finstern auf den Augen, black in front of your eyes, when the world is always bleak, when things are depressing, let's take this issue right now with Gaza. You have all these reporters saying, if Israel invades Gaza, Morsi is going to get upset with us, the Egyptian guy, you know, he's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, we should really worry if he's upset with us or not. And this is going to happen, and oy vey, what the President of the United States is going to happen. Or, if we invade Gaza, and we knock out these terrorist lowlifes, Jews in Israel are going to live in peace. One's optimistic and one's pessimistic. One's worried what some guy in Washington is going to say, because he happens to have an office on Pennsylvania Avenue. And one's saying that we as Jews have a destiny, we should be proud of who we are. Can be negative or positive. When you have the negative, you can't do anything. Because oy vey, what's going to be? And that touches every aspect of our lives.
Sometimes it's better to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission.
That's also true. That's a different issue. I don't want to focus here on the political issue. I just mentioned it to stick something in on the side here because I have a point of view. Yeah?
There's a book, I learned everything in kindergarten or something. Well, I learned most everything about individuals by watching Christopher Robbins and the 100 Acre Woods.
Well, I don't know what that is.
Eeyore is the negative. You have kids? You guys know what I'm talking about.
Your moms.
Yeah, my mom and dad. So. But there's Eeyore, and then there's Tigger, and everybody else, okay? Eeyore was always, oh, father. Everything was always, I know people like that. Right now. And when I see them, I think they're like Eeyore.
So let me ask you a question. Okay. There's the old song we all know, If I Was a Rich Man. Da 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 da. You know, I'm not a good singer. You want Rabbi Levy, he's better. So what would make you into a happier person? What is going to make us into a happier person? What's the if? Anybody have a suggestion?
I was always around positive people.
Always around positive people. Anybody else have? Yes?
You're happy. You're okay with yourself.
If you're okay with yourself. So let's read some, if I was in touch what I really want, which is what you're saying, okay? Or, I were immersed myself in a noble cause, I feel a sense of accomplishment and achievement. Or maybe, I live in the moment more often, I try to utilize every minute and realize it's valuable. Or, I had a better job and a better pay. Or, I had a bigger house for my family. And finally, if I had an iPhone 5. For those droid guys, what can I tell you? Somebody in Brooklyn in the JLI office wants an iPhone 5. Maybe we should collect some money and send to the person who does the slide the iPhone 5. Anyway, the point over here is, what does it see from this? It's not things that makes us more happy. It's not things. It's much deeper stuff than that. So that you want to read next? 6A. Very interesting study by psychologists.
In 1978, a trio of psychologists curious about happiness assembled two groups of subjects. In the first were winners of the Illinois State Lottery. These men and women had received jackpots of between $50,000 and $1 million. In the second group were victims of these devastating accidents. Some had been left paralyzed from the waist down, while the others' paralysis started at the neck. The researchers asked the members of both groups a battery of questions about their lives. On a scale of the best and worst things that would happen, how did the members of the first group rank becoming rich and the second richer bound? How happy had they been before these events? How about now? How happy did they expect to be in a couple of years? How much pleasure did they take in daily experiences, such as talking with a friend, hearing a joke, or reading a magazine? For a control, the psychologists assembled a third group made up of Illinois residents selected at random from the phone book. When the psychologists tabulated the answers, they found that the lottery groups rated winnings as a highly positive experience, and the accident group ranked the victimhood as a negative one. Clearly, the winners realized that they had been fortunate, but this only made the subsequent results more positive. The winners considered themselves no happier at the time of the interviews than the members of the group of the control group did. In the future, the winners expected to become slightly happier, but once again, no more so than the control group members. Even the accident victims expressed to be happier than the lottery winners within a few years. Meanwhile, the winners took significantly less pleasure in daily activities, including clothes buying, than the members of the two other groups.
So in other words, winning all the money didn't make you the happiest person in the world. I wish God would test me with this thing. I said, please, please, God, test me. Doesn't work. Okay? And we see for the next reading what tells us that even though per capita income is going up in America, people are happy or pretty happy. It didn't change dramatically. So what do we see from this? That it's not physical things or the iPhone 5 or whatever is going to make somebody happy. It's going to be something on the inside. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more. It's going to be something that we have the sense of who we are on the inside, which is going to make us happy. You know, it may give us that instantaneous, you know, sense of pleasure. You know, you walk around and everybody's got the iPad. Am I going to finally get one? You buy it, you feel good for a couple of days. But after a week or two, you know what? It gives you that instant gratification, but it doesn't last forever. We all know that when we're buying a car. You know, oh, I want that car. I want that car. And you know how they sell you the car. It's not they're selling you a vehicle of transportation. They're telling you this represents your personality and who you are. It's an expression of your identity. And of course, if you're a successful man, you got to buy a fancier car because you have to tell the whole world you're running in a fancier car. You know, all the mishigas goes along with this. Nevertheless, what you find is once you get it, it's not the end of the world, not the beginning of the world. Now we're going to take a little bit of a digression, and we're going to look at something which is a tough thing to deal with. And I don't have all the magic answers, but it's a perspective that's in Judaism it's important to understand, which is that when we go through difficult things and we go through hardship, misfortune, there's really two levels of consciousness. That the difficult and hardship we find many times deals with things which have within them hidden good. And a lot of times we don't understand that the challenges we have are really, they're going to bring out something which is much different. Now, this is a hard thing to deal with because first thing you're going to say to me, what's with the Holocaust? So I'm not going to answer the question because I have the same question. But we all see the question is what happens to us, which apparently is misfortune. Is there something different? You want to read the next you want to read to us text number 7?
I have a quick question though.
Yeah.
Is this Chabad philosophy or is this traditional Jewish philosophy?
Let me explain you what this is. Within the traditions of Judaism, there is a this is a Kabbalistic perspective as accentuated by Hasidic philosophy. But the ideas here are dominant ideas that existed classically in Jewish philosophy. Chabad in particular puts a focus on mysticism and Kabbalah. This is the class, the Kabbalah view. So what Hasidic philosophy does is takes the concept of Kabbalah and brings them down to a level the average person can understand. And the idea of a Jew, for instance, let's take the simple idea. Ivdus Hashem b'simcha, serve your God with joy. It's classic Jewish theology. Now what happens within the Hasidic world, we put a greater emphasis on the idea of joy than other parts maybe of the traditional Jewish world. But the concepts are all classic Jewish theology. Okay? And what there is within different trends within the traditional Jewish world, you'll find a different kind of emphasis sometimes on different ideas. Chassidim try to be happy. And that's one of the but it doesn't, but the idea is not something new, it's rather accentuating a concept which was always there. And what mysticism, what Chassidic philosophy does, is take these concepts that are embedded in Kabbalah and brings them down to a level, you know, listen, to read the Zohar and the word, classic works of Kabbalah is like taking a six-year-old child and giving him upper-level trigonometry. He's not going to understand what's going on. What Chassidic philosophy does is takes the concepts of Kabbalah and makes them understandable to the average human being. So now, one of the great classics of that is the Tanya, written by Rishneir Zalman of Liadi, the founder of Chabad, where he embodies within him are all the great Kabbalistic concepts, but in a way that average human beings can understand. And now we're going to deal with this tough issue, which is what happens when things don't look so sweet. So read to us number 7.
Sound advice has been offered by our sages on ridding one's heart of all sadness, of any trace of worry concerning worldly matters, even children, health, or livelihood. There's a well-known saying of the sages, just as one blesses God for the good, so too one should bless God for that which is not good. Talmud explains this to mean that one should accept misfortune with joy, just like the joy in a visible and obvious good. For the misfortune, too, is for the good, except that it is not apparent and visible to mortal eyes, for it stems from the hidden world, which is higher than the revealed world.
So we in Judaism, classically in Kabbalah, is that we have two levels of the world. We have the physical world we see, and the spiritual world which is hidden from us. And what happens in the revealed world, there may be something that's happening beyond that in the unrevealed world. Because classic Jewish belief is that there is a God that is omnipotent, which means all-powerful, omniscient, which is all-knowing, and benevolent, which is good. But we also don't necessarily understand why what we consider bad things is happening to us. The theology that you find in Kushner's book, Why Bad Things Happen to Jewish People, is not Judaism. It's really a liberal Western view which has nothing to do with classic Jewish theology. In Jewish theology, the good and the bad we make blessings for. When you hear the news that somebody died, what is the blessing you make? Blessed be the righteous judge. If the person that passed away left you a will, then you're supposed to make a bless, a toiv ha-meitiv, God gave you goodness. In other words, there's the good and the bad, and we accept that both come from God. Because why? Because God is all-powerful, God is all-knowing, and God is in the essence good. But what we don't understand is why these things are happening. Because there's a concept of a revealed good and a concealed good. Now this is not an easy thing to do. And listen, as a person who sat with a kid in the hospital for 2.5 years, it's not always easy to understand why you have to go through suffering, or why your children have to go through suffering, why things can't just be easy, why this is not meant to be. I had an incident last week. I thought when I was leaving to New York that somebody who had passed on had left the shul a very large amount of money. When I got to New York, I spoke to the attorney and I found out that not only there was not really nothing there, but we had been written out of the will, which I think was done illegally in the last period of the person's life. So I was very depressed, to be understated, last Thursday afternoon. So I walked into the lobby of the Brooklyn Marriott, which where we were having the conference, and I sat next to a friend of mine, another Chabad rabbi who I know from since we were young kids, who has lost 3 different children. And I said to him, I told him, I'm like devastated. He says to me, David, it wasn't meant to be. There's something else you need to accomplish. Now, what does that mean? I have to knock on more doors? If you see me coming in your direction, you should hide. You know what I mean? But I thought that we were going to put the institution on a whole different kind of setting. And we have to pay the mortgage off in the next month and all kinds of issues. And I thought everything was going to be easy. Well, guess what? It didn't work out the way I planned. And I truly was very depressed. And here's a man that has lost a group of children. And 2 years ago, I sat with him in a hospital room. And the night before his son died, a man who was in his 30s, and we hugged and we talked. And the 2 days later, we stood at the graveside together. And he's telling me that I should be optimistic. Well, meanwhile, nothing else happened in that kind of positive financial direction. But nevertheless, it was a really big shaking thing to me. But a lot of what's dealing with this issue And so we ask ourselves, why everything God does for good, why is there so much pain and suffering? And the answer is we don't really know the answer. However, there's the way we look at the world. If you have a kid who's 7 years old, and you go to them and you say to them, it's your birthday, so I'm taking $10,000, I'm putting in a CD in the bank, and when you're 25, you're going to have $25,000, $30,000. Is the kid happy? No. The kid wants a $20 toy truck from Toys R Us. They don't see the inner good in what you're doing. They don't understand that. The same thing when you tell a kid not to touch a child, not to, what's his name, not to touch a hot stove or not to run to the street. They don't understand what we're going to do. Now this, if we, these are children in relation to us, how much more so human beings in relationship to God? We don't understand that maybe there's something else which is supposed to happen, and that there is hidden good and there is revealed good. It is a difficult concept to accept, to be very honest. And it's something that I struggle with. To be honest, last Thursday, I was struggling big time. Really, really major league. Because I was about as devastated as you could get. And nevertheless, these are all things. This is, the question is, what is the inner purpose? What is the inner purpose? So I said to my friend, I said, maybe this means that I'm supposed to go knock on somebody's door that I never knocked on before. And because I will knock on his door, he will give charity and get involved with Judaism that he never got involved with before. Maybe that's the purpose. I really don't know what it is. Again, if I knock on your door, lock the door. But never, seriously speaking, you have to think to yourself, why is this happening? You don't know. So we're going to look at a story here about Rabbi Akiva, which goes seminally to the idea of how we look at the world. Ron, look, read the story of Rabbi Akiva, the great Talmudic sage.
Once while traveling, Rabbi Akiva arrived from a town and saw the place of the lodge, but he was refused everywhere. Everything God does is for the good.
So he said, "Call Ma'alelasa." He says, "Everything that God does is for the good." He couldn't. They didn't give him where to sleep. He had to go live in a field. So continue.
He said, and he went.
So with Rabbi Akiva, the concealed good became the revealed good very quickly. So let me tell you a funny story. There was a Jewish guy called Yankel. He walked into the local pet shop. His wife had died. He was a little bit lonely. And he walks inside the pet shop and he finds a parrot that speaks Yiddish. I told the story before?
Yes.
I told the story a couple years ago at Rosh Hashanah. But whatever it is, I'll tell you the story again. It's a good story. So he talks to the guy, he speaks Yiddish, it's unbelievable. And it says, Shalom Aleichem. He says, Aleichem Shalom, Basmachzu, if Machzach Gan's good. Everything's fantastic. So rolls around Rosh Hashanah, and he brings the guy, the parrot, to shul. There's a tumult in the shul, a givalt. Who can bring in a parrot? He says, you'll see, he speaks, this is the parrot, but speaks Yiddish. So they start going back and forth. They said, you know what, we're going to set up a gambling pool. He says, we're going to bet you $500 that this parrot doesn't speak Yiddish. So Yankel says, no problem, he knows the parrot speaks Yiddish. So he's going to go, and he says, put up the money, no problem, after Yontif, they're going to get the money. Again, in Chabad, we only take $100,000 and above on Yontif. Anyway, seriously speaking, and we have a guy that takes the money for us. Anyway, seriously speaking, they turns to the parrot and he says, "Nu, Zogapis, say something." The parrot says nothing. And then he's so angry, he walks out of shul, he turns to the parrot, because of you, I lost $500. So the parrot says, well, don't imagine what the odds are going to be on Yom Kippur. The point is, sometimes we don't understand what's in the offing for us. There's hidden good and there's revealed good. There's a hidden world, there's a spiritual world. And we don't really understand. And no parent would try to explain to a toddler why something might hurt him when you want to give a kid a shot. We don't understand what's going on. But we have to realize that we need to understand that it's a question about how we look at the world. Sometimes we only see bad, but sometimes what really happening is going to see something which is ultimately good. I want to show a movie. It's a little bit painful to watch, but I'm going to show you this short little film.
Thank you. late was a challenge they didn't want.
I mean, the world was a bad dream. I thought I'd just wake up 30 minutes or more. I was not sure whether I was going to take him home. And so I was going to be looking after him.
My dad was saying that he was, you know, his head was next to my mum's head as I was being born, and he saw my shoulder, and he just went pale. He was hoping my mum didn't see me, because he saw that I had no right arm. My dad had to leave the room, and he couldn't believe what he saw, and the doctor came in, and my dad said, "My son, he has no right arm." And he says, "No, your son has no arms or legs." And he said he knew what he felt before, he couldn't believe it. I have a choice to either be angry at God for what I don't have or be thankful for what I do have.
How did I get from depressed to who I am today? Because I tell you, I was depressed. When I was eight, I used to concentrate on the things I didn't have. I wish I had arms and legs, and I wish I could do this, but what can I do? You see, I have a choice. That's what I want to talk about today, choices. I can either be angry for not having arms and legs or be thankful for my chicken drumstick. You see, I can still do a lot of things. At home, I can brush my teeth, comb my hair, get myself ready in the morning. And I'm traveling around the world. It's amazing.
Boy, this was a tough one. When I watched this, the first time I said, this is a tough one. But we have to tell ourselves something very honest. The path to happiness is a large degree to one's perception. And Rabbi Akiva would always look for good. And I skipped the second, I think I skipped the second story about Rabbi Akiva, which tells a whole, did I do the second story of Rabbi Akiva? Oh, I think we should do the second story of Rabbi, it was always looking for good. And the question over here is how we see the world. Do we look for the good or do we look for the bad? Do we have a fender bender? Last Wednesday, I was trying to go to the airport to go to New York for the convention of the rabbis, and we were running late. We were trying to get a seat. You couldn't get a seat to New York. And I said to Naomi was going to drive me and Rabbi Levy to Ontario Airport, and I ran and parked my car in front of her house, and she has this new van, and she's backing out, and she hits my car. So she gets a damage on her back of her van, and I get a little damage. I said, Naomi, it's just a car. We can fix it. It's a minor damage. Do we get all upset about the fender bender? What we really, really need to understand that the real key is our perception of things. When we look deeper and we look for the inner good, this is what we find. And with Rabbi Akiva, he had a very big problem because here he was an illiterate shepherd who was employed by a wealthy man called Kaba Savua. It's a true story. And he was attracted to the boss's beautiful daughter. And Rachel, the daughter, the feelings were mutual, and she said she agrees to marry Akiva. He didn't have the big diamond that you had, Howard. And he says, but one condition, you have to go to study Torah. So we see, so here's a story about Kalba Savua and Rabbi Akiva, the whole story of Rabbi Akiva's daughter. Who's next? You want to read?
Yeah.
Okay, read this, the next reading, which is number 9.
Okay. The daughter of Kalba Savua was
he was a very rich man at the time.
To Rabbi Akiva. When Kabbalah Surah heard of this, he would that they would not benefit from any of possessions. In spite of this, she went and married Rabbi Akiva in the cold of winter. As a result of this poverty, they slept in the straw hat, and Rabbi Akiva would pluck the straw from his wife's hair. He says to her, if I had the means, I would place upon your head of the gold. The Peter Yubanovich is in Gate, the city of Jerusalem. Elia, the prophet, came, appearing in the gaze of the person, and called out of the door, please give me a little straw, for my wife has given birth, and I have nothing upon which lay their daughter. Rabbi Akiva said to his wife, see,
what happened is Rabbi Akiva realized that he was taking for granted that somebody could have even less than him. And Elijah the prophet coming was to teach him the lesson to be happy with what he has. Because you never know who can be happier than. We live, let's be very honest, in a place of plenty. And the license plate, it says, Yorba Linda is the land of gracious living. There's no real crime here. You can find, it's not like Brooklyn, you can find a parking spot. Alternate street parking is the greatest oppression in New York. There is, that we live a comfortable life. You can go shopping. You can do wherever you want. You can get around here. There's entertainment. There's this, there's that. We live pretty much quite good. Nobody's bombing and shelling us. There's no great risks in our lives. And sometimes we're not really happy. Why? Because we don't understand what we're missing. And we always think, is I'd be happier, what, if I would have had a... And the question is, what is going to make us realize that we're happier? Number one, if I realize that I have what I have is special and good, we're going to be a lot happier person. But there's one other element in this, which means we have to recognize the good that we have. And reading 10 continues about this study. You want to please read to us reading 10? Continues, what was the next piece of that study? About the people in the lottery and the ones who won, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, read 10.
Okay. Every week, the study's participants kept a short journal. They either briefly described in a single sentence five things that they were grateful for and that had occurred in the past week, the gratitude condition. Or they did the opposite, describing five daily hassles from the previous week, the hassles condition. That they were displeased about. The neutral group was simply asked to list five events or circumstances that affected them in the last week. And they were not told to accentuate the positive or negative aspects of these circumstances, the event condition. At the end of 10 weeks, we examined the differences between the three groups on all the well-being outcomes that we measured. At the onset of this study, participants in the gratitude condition felt better about their lives as a whole and were more optimistic about the future than participants in either of the other control conditions. To put it into numbers, according to the scale we used to calculate the well-being, they were a full 25% happier than the other participants. Those in the gratitude condition reported fewer health complaints and even spent more time exercising than the control participants did. The gratitude group participants experienced fewer symptoms of physical illness than those in either of the other two groups.
So the difference was not in what they did, it's what they perceived was different. And because of their perception, they reported less health complaints because they felt better about their lives, because they said thank you for the good things that are happening to them. They understood the value of recognizing the good and thanking for good. This concept of saying thank you is essential, and it had to do before the way they perceived the situation and the fact that their thoughts were put into writing. And then we see something very powerful in Judaism. Is embedded in Judaism is this idea of saying thank you. In Judaism, if you open up a prayer book, every morning we say a series of morning blessings. Joel, you want to read to us about the morning blessings?
Blessed be you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who grants us vision, literally opens the eyes of the blind.
This is the first blessing. We're thanking God that we can see. Continue.
Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who grants us mobility, literally releases the bound. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who grants us the ability to stand, literally straightens the bowed. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who grants us clothing, literally clothed and naked. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who gives strength to the weary.
So what does Judaism do for us every morning? You wake up in the morning, you open a prayer book, and the first thing you're supposed to do is say the morning blessing, thanking God for the good things that you have in your life. Sight, mobility, clothing, ability to stand, and other things also. What does this do? It embeds in us a sense of gratitude for the good we have. When you have that sense of gratitude for the good you have, the whole way you approach the day is different. It's not that something you're obligated to get, or I went last week to Nordstrom's, and I was going to buy that purse. The last minute, somebody got the one before me, and they're out of stock. It was a big sale, I could have gotten it. No, we're happy for the things that we have. And when a person thanks God, is happy for what they have, their whole attitude to life changes. But if we're always looking about what we don't have, then you end up with having nothing. And because, and so there, and this idea of gratitude is central to us, and we have a renewed strength upon awakening. This is all central to how we approach the world. Because then we're happier people, because we're acknowledging the good, and we're looking for the things that are good in our lives. And sometimes they're simple. The fact that we can get up and we can move around is a great thing. You know, if you can't move around, it's not such a wonderful thing. If you don't have what to put on your clothes, it's not so great. So you didn't get the thing on sale last week. Big deal. Renewed strength upon awakening is a wonderful thing. All of these things. And those of us who, if you happen to get a little bit older, then you begin to realize how much it is even more so. It's a question of how we approach the world. But there's one other step. Let's go read this. Go read one.
Happiness results when one receives an undeserved and undeserved gift. It does not result when one receives...
One second, what are you reading?
12B.
What? Oh, leave 12A first, then 12B. In other words, if we have humility and recognize the goodness that God gives us, we're going to have a joy. Now continue at 12B.
Happiness results when one receives an unearned and undeserved gift. It does not result when one receives that which he rightfully earns. Therefore, one who lacks humility and is consumed with feelings of self-importance cannot attain complete joy. For no matter what he possesses, he feels as though he deserves everything. Moreover, for the same reason, should he lack it, he will be rejected. Only the humble person is completely joyful over that which he possesses, for he feels that he does not deserve it. Moreover, he will not be sad if he lacks something, inasmuch as he does not feel that he is being deprived of something he deserves. Though the humble person is aware of his talents and strength, he understands that he cannot take credit for them, for they are God's given. Furthermore, a humble person feels that had God given those talents and strength to another, that person might have utilized them more perfectly.
If you walk around and say, I'm owed it, you know, you walk in the shul and you think you should have the front row seat. Or you want to go someplace, you think, I owed all these things. But if you come with a sense of humility, something happens to it, you're thankful for the good that happens to you. So humility is a very important thing. And humility is a key to increasing your happiness, because you don't expect, this expression in Yiddish is kupmir, that thing, I should be getting that. No, you're happy for what you have. It's a whole different kind of attitude. And then you're going to have a greater sense of happiness for the good things that you get. So let's ask ourselves a question. Learning a number 60, page 64. List three things that you're grateful for today. Anybody want to make a suggestion, something they're grateful for?
Good health.
Good health. Anybody else?
My five kids.
Your five kids?
My friends.
Your friends? Anybody else?
Here.
What?
Shelter.
She was 27 days on a ship to Australia. That was interesting shelter. A slow boat to Sydney. You what? Anybody else?
My hip isn't killing
you. Your hip isn't killing you.
Today.
It should not kill you tomorrow. We should all give her a blessing. Her hip shouldn't kill her tomorrow.
Just being here.
Mike is happy being in shul, okay? So we all have our things and we can find a sense of thankfulness and we have a sense of humility. But when we begin to wake up in the morning and we look, and this is one of the things that Judaism teaches us, to say those morning blessings, to thank God for the good things that happened to us, to see the positive things in our world. Because it's, again, how you perceive the world. Looking for the good. When a humble person does not take the blessings for granted, and he's joyful over what he possesses, for he feels he doesn't really deserve it. You think everybody owes you something, you feel totally different. So we should be happy for what we have. But what is the problem? We have a struggle. What is the struggle? We have a struggle every single day. What this point of this course, the Kabbalah of You, is to uncover the floorboards. And what we studied in the earlier classes is, again, we are a bit schizophrenic. We have an animalistic soul, which is concerned with being self-centered and self-absorbed and doing what's the physical. And we have a godly soul. And the struggle we have is to recognize that battle which is going on, and then slowly and make the godly soul the one which is dominant. because you can't get rid of the animal soul. It's always going to be there. All you can do is you can constrain it. A very holy person can take the animal soul and make it into good. But the rest of us, we're struggling with this animalistic soul. And what we need to do, and it wants to make us miserable. It wants to make us depressed. It wants to make us self-absorbed. It wants us to make us feel that everything belongs to us, that we deserve this and we deserve that. But comes the godly soul and teaches us the opposite. It teaches us humility. It teaches us to recognize the good. And we also dig a little deeper that the true joy is going to happen when we look into what the godly soul has to do. That is what we're going to understand, what is really good. And we also can realize that godly soul can teach us that sometimes we can be happy with less. We don't always need so many things. Sometimes when we're younger, we think we need this, we need this, we need this. You don't always need something. It looks about how we look at the world. Is the cup half full or is the cup half empty? Because it's really a sense about how we look at these types of things. And the person who's guided by the feelings of the soul, where the godly soul is becoming the animate, the dominant, the most important thing, looks for the deeper, looks for the good. Oh, so many wonderful things happened to me today. This blessing happened. This must be for good. I want to tell you, when this thing happened to me last Thursday, and I sit down with a friend of mine who's lost 3 children, and he tells me it's got to be for a deeper inner purpose, I'm just flabbergasted. If anybody should not feel joyous, it's him. But nevertheless, he gave me, so to speak, the oomph to continue functioning. And that is the problems we have. You know, the story is told. Remember, in one of the earlier lessons, we told you a story about Rav Zushi of Anapol, the guy who was looking around for himself. So one of the people once came to the Magid of Mizrich, Rav Dov Ber, the great Hasidic master, and they asked him to please, he'd like to learn about how to be a happy person. So he says, and how can you be happy? He says, you need to go learn by Rav Zushi. So he goes to Rav Zushi, the same Rav Zushi of Anapol, great Hasidic teacher, great spiritual man. He comes in, the house is a hovel. He's got kids that are sick. The people are hungry. Everything is miserable. And he's the happiest guy alive. So the man says to him, the Magi told me to come here. The rabbi told me to come here to learn from you. How about happiness? And he said to them, he said, maybe you can give me the answer. He says, what's the question? He was found goodness in whatever he had. He looked only to be for the positive. He only looked for the good things that were happening in his life, and that's why he was going to find, and that's why he was going to succeed. So this, the way we can learn to achieve joy, is a very central idea. We got to look for the deeper spiritual side. Let's look at reading number 13. Mike, you want to read to us 13?
One's lifelong service of God should be with tremendous joy. The joy of the soul upon transcending the confines of the body during the times of Torah study and prayer, and returning to her father's house as in her youth. This is a comparable to a prince who is free to return to the house of his father, the king after having been in captivity, compelled to turn a millstone in prison while covered with filth. There is no joy as great as that of being released from exile and captivity. True, the body remains unsublimated, inasmuch as, despite one's prayer and Torah study, the essential character of the animal soul has not been transformed to holiness. Nevertheless, one should allow the good, godly soul to be more precious in his eyes than the body, so he rejoices in the soul's joy without letting sadness on account of his body interfere with or disturb the joy of the soul.
So as we learned in the first lesson, the soul is a stranger here in this physical world. And it's like a prince in captivity. And it's the source of a person's vitality and energy. It's a holy kind of energy. We have to release the prince for captivity and let the godly soul shine out and look for the good and look for the optimistic and look for the positive instead of looking for the animalistic soul that brings us down and pulls us up. I want to tell you a story, and when we release that energy, there's no great, as great as that being released from exile to captivity. I want to tell you 2 stories. One is a story about Natan Sharansky, who I saw last week actually at a conference in Washington, Baltimore. Sharansky is a famous Jewish refusnik. He was in prison, and there was 2 guys interrogating him. Probably the 2 guys were interrogating him because they wanted to make sure that one guy didn't do something he couldn't do. So in the middle of the interrogation, he starts telling the guys, he tells the 2 interrogators a joke about then the premier of Russia, Brezhnev. And when he finishes telling the joke, he begins laughing. And the 2 guys are holding themselves back. He says, you know what? You are so much in jail that you can't even laugh at a really good joke. The fact of the matter is that he was looking, that it's an inner sense of jail. He was the free man, even though he was the one being interrogated, not the interrogators. And I want to tell you, so when we, at every moment, we have an ability to release that prince from captivity, to release that inner spiritual quality of us, to release that inner human quality. And I want to share you one other story with the famous Chassid of Mendel Futafas, who was my teacher in yeshiva. This is a picture of a Mendel. And this is a picture of Ramenda putting on tefillin with Prime Minister, later to be Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. I added this slide into the thing this morning. I decided to throw it in for you. Ramenda, when he came to the yeshiva, we were shocked with Ramenda, the students. Here was a man who spent 9 years in Siberia. Why did he spend 9 years in Siberia? He didn't do anything illegal. He was part of the Jewish underground in Russia. What was the Jewish underground doing in Russia? It wasn't blowing up buildings. It wasn't sending missiles to attack people. It was educating Jewish children and helping people being smuggled out of Russia. And including those people that were smuggled out of Russia were Rabbi Levy's grandparents and my other son-in-law in San Francisco, Rabbi Zarki's grandparents. He was involved in organizing the Jewish underground smuggled out of Russia in 1946, the beginning of 1947, almost 1,000 Jews. They went out on false Polish passports. It's a story into itself. And what happened was that Mendel was arrested because they found out that he was involved in doing this. He was sent to Spolenka prison in St. Petersburg. You probably know where that is. Rita knows where. She wasn't in Spolenka prison. You were there, were you? She was around. She walked around. And then he was sent up to Siberia. So in Siberia, Mendel was famous for his stories. So in Siberia, they would sit around, and there was all these kinds of people, and they were all lamenting their lives. So the doctor who was arrested by the KGB, when he was arrested again in 1946, 47, so he was in that period between 47 and 57, he was in prison. So what happened was, or I think he was released in 50, it was in about 56, 57, he was released in prison. He didn't get out of Russia till 62. So 2 weeks before the assassination of President Kennedy. So what happened was, is that the doctor was sitting in the prison and saying, "Oi, I lost everything. I used to be a physician. I used to be a doctor. I practiced medicine." The other guy was a writer, but apparently he wrote something the communists didn't like. He was lamenting, "I used to be a writer. I have nothing to do anymore." And then there was the businessman. He says, "I lost all my business. It's all been ruined." So they turned to the Mendel. He says, "Why are you so happy?" He says, "Because nothing changed in my life." He says, "What do you mean?" He says, "My job is to serve God. So I can serve God in prison and serve God on the outside. I haven't lost my purpose of being existing. I haven't lost my purpose of being. It doesn't make a difference if I'm in the prison or out of the prison." Of course, in the prison is not a sweet place to be. He didn't want to be in the prison. But that sense that no matter where I am doing what my mission in life is. And so therefore, he was the happiest guy in the jail because they couldn't take that sense of inner humanity away from him. You know, Moshe Dayan writes in his autobiography about being put into the Arco prison, in the Arco prison in 1946 or 47, and in the next cell over was a religious Jew. And it was Friday night, and Dayan was far from a religious Jew. He grew up in the kibbutz. And he said that he listened in the next cell how the Jew was sitting and singing Shabbos melodies. He says, the man was a free man because he transcended the boundaries of that, what's his name, his soul came out. So the question is, how do we approach life? We can look for the joy, which we can find in everything we do, and the joy of doing a mitzvah. And it wasn't that Mendel Futafas had the opportunity to do a mitzvah with Yitzhak Rabin. It was the fact that Yitzhak Rabin had an opportunity to do a mitzvah with his Mendel Futafas. Because the spiritual giant of the two was without question Rabbi Mendel, even though Yitzhak Rabin did many things for Israel and he was a great patriot and a great general. Nevertheless, the point is, it's what we look at, that inner quality, that inner goodness. And if we look for the good, for the positive in what we do every single day, and we say that we may have difficulties, and we look for what it may mean to us in the long run, the lessons it's going to teach us, and we look for we look to give thanks to God for the good things we have in our life, then our whole attitude to life is fundamentally different. And then we can fill the dictate, as Maimonides said, is an obligation of a Jew to serve God with joy. Our whole obligation is to be joyful with other people. You know, I got off a plane last week, so I always say to the flight attendant, thank you very much, I had a very nice ride. Why? And I say, give them a smile. Because I figure they're looking at me because I'm a rabbi. And you know, I look the part, how many guys are sitting in the plane looks like me. The truth is, I look normal and everybody else looks different. I'm a regular guy. I look like, you know. They think you live in Brooklyn, you live in California. You know what I mean? Where do you live? I don't live in Brooklyn, I live in California. Anyway. So, and then I'll start singing the Beach Boys songs. Anyway, let's go. Anyway, we're not going to sing them right now. The point I'm saying is that you say a kind word, it makes a difference. And that, and it's how we look at, it's our attitude. It's our perception. And the Torah teaches us that we have a mitzvah to be happy and a mitzvah to be joyous, and we have to look for the upbeat and we have to look for the good. And this is what Judaism is teaching us, that the idea of happiness is one which is on the internal. It's not about the toys we get or the guy has a license plate that the one who dies with most toys dies. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way in this world. It's the goodness, the joy that we find in our lives and the good things that we do.
It is of great importance to take joy in the performance of mitzvah. This demonstrates an appreciation for the commandments and acknowledges that we cherish our relationship with God. 2. Happiness breeds success.
Sorry, I made a mistake. It'll work now.
Key points. It is of great importance to take joy in the performance of mitzvah. This demonstrates an appreciation for the commandments and acknowledges that we cherish our relationship with God. 2. Happiness breeds success. When we are happy, we are able to overcome challenges and exert more self-control. It is also impossible to vanquish the animal soul unless one is joyful. Over the past 3 decades, the real per capita income has seen a significant increase. Nevertheless, the percentage of people who describe themselves as very happy has remained unchanged. Clearly, having more does not necessarily increase happiness. 4. The Talmud explains that one should accept misfortune with joy, for it too is for the good, except that its goodness is not apparent and visible to mortal eyes. While this might be extremely difficult to understand and implement during the most difficult times, we can more easily apply to this idea by appreciating the good we too often take for granted. 5. Gratitude is a prerequisite to happiness. It compels us to ponder the many blessings that we have. Jewish prayers are replete with passages in which we declare our gratitude. 6. Humility leads to gratitude. When people feel overly deserving, they are less thankful and less joyous. 7. One mustn't allow any sort of sadness to disturb from tapping into the joy of the soul, which is the person's essence. The soul experiences extreme joy every time it connects to God through Torah and Mitzvot.
Okay, next week, even though it's Thanksgiving weekend, I want to hear a vote of hands. Should we have the class or not? I would like to teach it. So please vote. How many of you want me to skip next Sunday? Raise your hand.
Skip next Sunday.
Because it's Thanksgiving weekend. How many of you want me to have the class next Sunday?
Voting twice.
What? Who's voting twice in Chicago?
I'm being Democrat today.